Gentlemen, as I mentioned last week, there's a big giveaway going on that I want you to be a part of. Head over to www.mountaintoppodcast.com/giveaway, where I've teamed up with my good friends and longtime supporters of this show, Keyport, to get you a big chance to win one of their Anywhere Tools bundles or one of their Pivot bundles. Now, what are these gadgets? Only the most kick-ass everyday carry devices you've ever seen in your entire life. Hey, this will replace your old-school pocket knife or even the clunky multi-tool you've been using with 21st-century technology. You got to check it out for yourself. Go to mountaintoppodcast.com/giveaway and be a part of this. It ends soon, so make sure you head over there right now. And now, here is a big-time fun episode with a longtime friend of mine who is known for writing outrageous best-selling books with equally outrageous titles. It's none other than Steve Seabold. Hang on tight and enjoy the show.
Live from the mist-enshrouded mountaintop fortress that is X and Y Communications headquarters, you're listening to the world-famous Mountaintop Podcast. And now, here's your host, Scott McKay.
Greetings, gentlemen. Welcome to yet another episode of the world-famous Mountaintop Podcast. My name is Scott McKay, at Scott McKay on Twitter, Real Scott McKay on Instagram, Scott McKay on YouTube. The website is mountaintoppodcast.com, and I invite you to join us once and for all on our thriving Facebook group, which is, as always, the Mountaintop Summit. Hey, I'm really excited today, gentlemen, because I'm welcoming back a guy I've interviewed before. Oh, I bet it goes back 10 years, like a full decade, when he wrote a book that particularly got my attention, which we're going to talk about, of course. And now he's back with a new book called How Money Works, Stop Being a Sucker. And his brand is Mental Toughness University. He's a great guy, and I'm sure we're going to have plenty of takeaways by the time this discussion is over. So without any further ado, Steve Seabold, welcome, man.
Hey, thanks, Scott. Great to be back.
Yeah. You know, you're a good dude and you shoot from the hip, which I love. And I remember when I first interviewed you, it was around your book with this incredibly polarizing title called Die Fat or Get Tough. And in a world where we're kind of tiptoeing through the tulip saying, oh, you know, you just need to change your diet. And my favorite catchphrase, when I say favorite, by the way, I mean least favorite, is if you're morbidly obese, it's not your fault. You know, all these marketing catchphrases to kind of rope people in as if there's some sort of easy button to losing, you know, to not being obese anymore. Yet here you go. You come along with a book called Die Fat or Get Tough, and you tell people the way it is. And I had the most fun reading the reviews on Amazon for this book because people absolutely left scathing reviews for this book because they just thought you were this mean man who was telling them they needed to lose weight or they're going to die. And oh my gosh, people are so mentally weak. And the truth of the matter is I've just lost 50 pounds, as these guys know. And it was my fault that I was 50 pounds overweight. And once I got tough about it, and your catchphrase, of course, die fat or get tough, was at the forefront of my mind. Some other influences, of course, like Jocko Willink and others. And I just decided, hey, you know what? It's time to man up. It's time to get this under control. And Steve, you run an outfit called Mental Toughness University, and that's basically your whole gig. Your newest book is called How Money Works, Stop Being a Sucker, which is just as polarizing a title. It just gets in everybody's face. And I'd love for you to tell us, first of all, how you arrived at this purpose in life, this grand purpose of helping people get tougher mentally.
Well, I was a professional tennis player back in the 80s, and I realized a long time ago that when all of the things are equal, the person with the mental toughness will be the person that typically wins. And so I really got kind of fascinated with the whole topic in the mid-1980s, started really studying it and figured out that the psychology of performance really applies to everything from losing weight to sports to money to sales to pretty much everything that we do. And so I've written 11 books now over the years and consulted, you know, lots of big corporations over the years all over the world, but all on the same topic, the psychology of performance, whether it's in money or, you know, anything else. And it's been a great ride.
Yeah, as Yogi Berra once said famously or infamously, depending on how you see it, 90% of this game is half mental. And I don't think he was just talking about baseball. Indeed, tennis, golf is amazingly mental. I mean, if you look in the past at some of the people who were atop the leaderboard at majors in golf tournaments, at some point in history, you'll see that certain of these guys just fall off the map. David Duval comes to mind. And, you know, here's a guy who was always challenging Mickelson and Tiger. And then one day he just wasn't winning anymore. I mean, even Tiger himself, you know, he attributes it to injury. But golf is an incredibly tough sport mentally. And to stay at the top of your mental game is probably near impossible. Hell, when I play 18 holes, I'm not sure I can stay mentally tough for nine of them before, you know, I'm wanting to throw a club Caddyshack style. So, yeah, sports is an incredible crucible to measure mental toughness. And I think a lot of times parents are saying to themselves, well, you know, I have to get my kids focused on academics and perhaps art or music, although sometimes those come in last place also. But a surprising number of parents don't understand how crucial to development getting involved in sports is for their kids, right?
Yeah, I really agree with that. I mean, it just prepares you for life. I mean, look at how crazy the world is right now. We were talking about some of the different things that are happening right now off before the show started. And, you know, you got to be mentally tough just to survive right now in the world. And so it really helps. And the kids that come up in sports have a great advantage because, you know, they learn a lot of these things. They learn a lot of the mental techniques that of high performing, you know, athletes and performers in all kinds of groups. And it really gives them a leg up.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's dive into this concept of mental toughness. When I think of mental toughness, I think of someone who takes responsibility instead of passing the buck of blame around. Someone who isn't offended so easily and, you know, can kind of take things in stride, perhaps take themselves less seriously. Someone who, if they fall, they pick themselves up and they dust themselves off and they try again. Someone who has a goal and stays focused on it. Someone who understands the dynamics of what would try to make us quit and perseveres anyway, without, of course, being stubborn about it, as we've talked about on this show. But I'd love to let you riff on your definitions of mental toughness. And I don't know if you agree with me or would add anything to it or flatly disagree, but I want to let you go for it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, I think it's all those things, Scott. It's a very broad topic. And so I think all the things you mentioned come under the mental toughness umbrella. We sort of, when we work with big companies, that's most of the work we do, what we have done over the last 25 years, big corporate sales teams like Johnson & Johnson and Microsoft and Procter & Gamble and those kinds of companies. We talk about it being, the definition being, you're the ability to control your emotions, especially in the sales process, or if it's an athlete we're working with, like we worked with the Boston Celtics years ago, you know, controlling your emotions when there's 3 seconds left on the clock and you're down by one and you got to take the shot, those types of things. But it really is, it's very specific in a way, but it also can be very broad, as you mentioned. And I mean, just mental toughness for life in general makes such a big difference. And I think what you said was probably the thing that people resonate most with over the last 25 years of doing this work, and that's taking responsibility for yourself. That maybe is the overall generic sort of umbrella type of definition that people really relate to, is taking responsibility. And a lot of people, as you know, don't want to do that.
Yeah, no question. I mean, you can go on Twitter and just see how many people want to blame someone else, even people in positions of leadership. And of course, sometimes I would say, probably most of the time, it's politically motivated. But in the current crises, plural, that are going on in the world, it's amazing how many politicians want to blame someone underneath them and somebody above them on the political ladder and bypass themselves. You know, it's just amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. They do. Yeah. Yeah. We worked some in politics over the years, and that is the nastiest game I have ever even seen up close. I could tell you stories you wouldn't believe, but we dabbled in it over the years because we've gotten calls from presidential candidates and over the years and tried to work with them a little bit. But they will say or do anything to get into office. It's just I got out of it because I just got out of the consulting world of doing that a few years back, because after the 2016 campaign, because they're just absolutely on both sides of the aisle. I mean, it's not one side or the other. It's both sides. They
agreed.
It's crazy. I mean, it's not even mental toughness. They will lie, cheat, and steal to get a lot. And again, it's both the Democrats, the Republicans, all of them in between, you know, the independents, the libertarians, all of them
worldwide,
right? Worldwide. It's, yeah, it's, yeah. something about that power they want, Scott. I don't understand it really, but I got out of that as fast as I could.
You know, it's funny. In my young naivete, like in my 20s, I would fantasize about running for Congress someday and changing the world. There's no way in hell I'd do it now. I mean, it's just basically signing off to ruin your life. You know, I mean, you know, guys I respect like Dan Crenshaw, God bless them. But, you know, that dude's going to wake up after a couple terms and go, you know, I think I'd rather go back into the private sector and do something where I'm going to be appreciated and not like mentally destroyed all day long. Although he's a former Navy SEAL. So if anybody can handle it, it'll be him. But, you know, the funny thing about politics is you can always, and I don't use the word always much. I always leave wiggle room in there for possibilities other than the inevitable always. But it seems to me that when you're dealing with something political, it's always about politics, first of all. Whenever politicians are dealing with anything, to try to dupe other people into thinking this isn't a political issue, you're kidding yourself. Second of all, it's always about reelection. And that's without exception. Both sides of the aisle. I mean, it's funny to me to watch Republicans blame all Democrats and Democrats blame all Republicans, you know. It's everybody. And the third one, probably the most important, follow the money. Yeah. Always. I mean, whatever's going to bring the cash is always going to be king.
We're getting old and skeptical, Scott.
I know, right? Exactly. Right. But there's nothing false about what I just said. And if you...
Nothing false about it, unfortunately.
It's like the three-legged stool of politics. But anyway, you're talking about sales teams. And I don't talk about sales and business much on this show. But having been in high ticket sales for years, sometimes with long sales cycles, mental toughness was absolutely crucial because you couldn't get greedy. You couldn't get needy. You had to put the customer's need first and bypass your own mental urgency about earning commission or whatever. And that's really hard to teach young greenhorn sales guys.
Oh, it really is. Yeah, because they're used to instant gratification. Microwave thinking. Everything happens in an instant. You know, it's an app. You want an answer, just look it up on Google. And so now you got to say, hey, as you mentioned, long sales cycles, the customer's got to be put first. Maybe you don't get a commission on the deal for 6 months or a year or 2 years. Yeah, and it's the younger they are, the tougher it is because they're used to, that instant commission or that instant gratification. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're knocking on a whole bunch of doors and you're going to lose a lot of deals typically. Right?
Absolutely. That's the game.
It is. It's like a sport. Yeah. It's a game.
Very much.
No question. And then there's always the idea. I know Jeffrey Gittimer likes to talk about this. You got to call a customer 7 times at least before you can expect to get a deal. And it's amazing how many salespeople who aren't very good at it will do a cold call or follow a lead. And when it kind of seems to go cold, they'll just give up. That's not mentally tough at all.
Right. I think about the things you bought in your life. I was thinking about it. I bought a car the other day, and I was thinking about all the cars I bought just when I was waiting to close the deal and get, you know, pick up the car. And I was thinking about all the cars I bought over the years, and I've hardly ever had a salesperson call me back and follow up after maybe the first month or so. And I thought of all those sales they lost because they don't even follow up after you purchase something. And some of these cars were, you know, relatively expensive where you'd think the commission would be pretty high and they'd want to follow up with you. But, hardly any of them ever have.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? You know, I bought a lot of cars over the course of my lifetime so far. And the only two guys I've ever bought multiple cars from, I bought at least 3 from each. And they both treated me like a human being instead of a prospect. And they followed up with me and they kept in touch with me. Both of them.
And they're like, absolutely. That doesn't hardly ever happen. That's the craziest part of it.
Well, I'll tell you what. Here's the number one rule of sales, as far as I'm concerned. It is infinitely easier to get a customer you already have to buy something else than it is to go find a brand new prospect and cultivate them. In other words, repeat business is a lot easier than going and generating new revenue.
Definitely.
Farming instead of hunting is a lot easier a sales profession, which is perhaps why hunters are held in such high esteem by high-level sales organizations, right?
Sure. Definitely. I agree.
It's all about mental toughness.
It really is. Yeah.
Yeah. So your new book is along the same lines, of course, of mental toughness, because that's your primary gig, but it's about finances, how money works. Stop being a sucker. How are we a sucker typically when we lack mental toughness, Steve? I'd love to hear your take on this.
Well, the problem is we don't know as a society, very few of us understand how money works. We're not taught in schools. And we're not taught, you know, even in university, we're not taught in college. I mean, they don't teach us the basics of what we need to know. So as a result, the financial industry takes advantage of us and they give us, you know, 0.09 on a passbook savings account or 0.01 in the case of my bank on a passbook savings account. So it's going to take 7,200 years for $1 to turn into $2. So that's nice. And then they come back and say, hey, Scott, here's a credit card. Thanks for your deposit. Here's a credit card you can take out at 17.5%. And their money doubles every 4 years. It's because we don't understand compound interest. We don't understand the time value of money, the rule of 72. These basic concepts that you could teach literally a 14-year-old kid. And that's why we wrote this book, me and my co-author, Tom Matthews. We wrote it so a young teenager could really understand it and apply it to their life immediately. And because these are things, again, we're just not taught. And so we get ripped off our whole lives.
Well, when I think of being a sucker with money, I think of obviously the P.T. Barnum inspired attitude. There's a sucker born every minute, which kind of rhymes with the saying, a fool and his money are soon parted.
Sure.
And when we're young and we lack life experience, we tend to do foolish things with money. The first thing that comes to mind there is how they set up tables at freshman orientation week in college and go, hey, you're on your own now. Get a credit card. It's like plastic money. And kids are like, oh, yeah. And they don't read the fine print. And of course, not reading the fine print is what gets us in trouble in all aspects of our lives cumulatively, I would argue. There's a lot of talk nowadays, more so than even usual, about the idea of systemic racism. And one of the ideas that came to mind in my own consideration of what that would mean, because a lot of people are having a hard time wrapping their head around what that is, really. Is it just a jingoistic saying, or is there really something to it? And I think there absolutely is something to it. The first thing that came to mind was when I was married to my first wife, she had a Hispanic maiden name. And we would get in the mail checks for like $23,872. And everything was written in Spanish. This is a real check. It's live. You can cash it right now. And it's money we've sent just to you. And in the fine print in the bottom was all English. And it said, this is a 28% loan.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And you know, you're going to have to start paying it back immediately. And that to me seemed so incredibly disrespectful and skeezy. And it would drive my wife at the time nuts. And we would get like two a week. And they were always addressed to her by her maiden name. And that's just taking advantage of people who aren't in a position to act properly on what's been sent to them in the mail. And I want to be completely clear. Do I believe most Hispanic folks who got that in the mail, even if they spoke only Spanish, were wise to it? Absolutely. I'm not sure what low percentage of people actually bit on that offer, but it must have been low because it was so unbelievably sleazy, like I said. And then shortly after that, by the way, as a footnote, they outlawed it and the check stopped.
Right.
But that's what I think of when I think of them trying to take advantage of somebody's position. Often when people are desperate for money, when they don't have the kind of finances flowing in that they would like, a lot of times businesses will set themselves up in neighborhoods that are low income with the specific purpose of separating the residents from their money. And that's pretty egregious also, if you ask me.
And they're very good at it. And they've been doing it for 150 years in this country because people don't know what they don't know. And like you say, they're desperate and they do. The financial service industry, unfortunately, is very predatory. I mean, they have been doing this for a long time. That's why Tom Matthews and I wrote this book, because we're trying to teach people the basics of how money works in a way that, again, a teenager, a 14-year-old kid could understand it. The book's only 128 pages long. It's very simple. There's characters in the book that talk to each other. We purposely wanted to make it simple because if you read financial books, you know, the only people that understand financial books are financial people. And so we're really trying to make a difference in the financial literacy rates in this country, which unfortunately are very low.
Well, for better or worse, virtually zero of my audience is under 18. So I don't believe I have a whole lot of 14-year-olds who are listening. So with that in mind, give us a couple teasers. Give us a couple practical ideas for guys who, you know, maybe are in their 30s or a little bit older. What are some blind spots a lot of us have where we're actually being suckers and perhaps don't even realize it?
Well, you know, like there's so many examples. It's unbelievable. I mean, car loans, for example, you know, take out a 5-year car loan, see what you calculate, how much it's going to cost you to take out a 5-year car loan, or calculate your mortgage. Look at how much your house is going to cost over a period of 15 or 30 years. And look at what you're paying in interest alone. And most people don't, if you ask people how much interest are you going to pay on that car loan over the course of X amount of years, they have no idea. They've never calculated. They just wanted the car. And so that's what we do, because we're never taught to think like that. So I would recommend, look at all the debt you have and look at how much it's going to cost you to own whatever, eventually own whatever it is you have the debt on. And it's astounding. And that's why so few people really have any money, Scott, because they don't really understand the basics of how it works. They're getting ripped off and they don't even know they're getting ripped off.
Yeah, what comes to mind is 12 months interest free.
There you go.
But the interest is compounding the whole time. So if you don't get it all paid off within 12 months, you're going to owe just a ginormous amount of interest. That comes to mind.
Scary. Yeah. And of course, rich people, they take those deals all the time. They take the 12 months, you know, interest-free financing, but most of people aren't rich and they don't pay it off. And then, like you say, then it accrues over the whole time compounding, and it's some monstrous number, and they don't figure it out before because they want the thing so badly. And it's just not something that we talk about in society, even in the richest country in the world.
Yeah, no kidding. I want to talk to you about the idea of having a mortgage versus renting. What if those are your only two options because I need somewhere to live? I want to live in a halfway decent house in a halfway decent neighborhood. It would seem obvious on the surface to me that having a mortgage certainly beats throwing all of your money into a black hole every month. What's your take on that?
It really depends, Scott. I mean, it's so individual. I mean, I recommend people, because it's so personal and so there's so many pieces of criteria to consider, that I would, you know, contact your financial professional over something like that, because it is so individual. But overall, I mean, certainly building equity in real estate is a good thing when the market's right. I mean, of course, you know, we've seen real estate never went down in this country until it did, you know, and a lot of us lost a bunch of money, myself included, millions of dollars, because we were holding so much real estate because it went down. So there are times when renting, that would have certainly been better for us to be renting at that point. But we didn't know the market was going to turn, of course, no crystal ball.
Yeah, that's a solid point.
Yeah, it's really so individual. Finance is so individual because there's so much criteria involved in each decision that you really have. That's why you work with a financial professional that can really guide you through the process.
Now, a lot of people, myself included, approach the concept of hiring a financial professional, you know, a money manager, with a lot of trepidation because precisely we're afraid of being suckered. How do you have the headlights on in a good, positive, wise way? And how do you exercise wisdom in hiring the correct money manager for you? How can we do that?
That's a great question. I think that really the answer is that make sure you're educated. Make sure, again, get a basic financial education. You don't have to have a degree in finance or anything like that. You just have to know the basics of how money works. I mean, if people read this book, honestly, they wouldn't have to read another book because they on finance, unless they wanted to. But because you can get the basics down that way when you're meeting with a financial professional and they say, well, look, you know, you really should have an insurance policy because you've got two kids or whatever the scenario is. And you can say, well, here's what I'd like to know. Can I get long-term care on an insurance contract? You know, and then they say, well, okay, now the financial pro says, okay, this person's obviously educated. They know what they're talking about. So do I have to have a standalone long-term care contract, or can I get a rider on an insurance contract for pennies on the dollar? And all of a sudden they go, okay, I can't fool this person. Not that they would do that, but obviously there's a percentage that would, but it's small. And most of the financial professionals, I mean, I've spoken to hundreds of thousands of them over the years as a speaker and an author and at conventions, and most of them are really, really upstanding people.
You know, that's interesting. The whole idea of insurance is so vexing to so many of us. What do we need insurance for? What do we definitely not need insurance for? And you just dropped a golden nugget of wisdom by saying instead of having a standalone insurance contract that you'd be paying for from the ground up, perhaps monthly or annually, you can get a rider on an existing insurance policy that would give it to you for pennies on the dollar. That's just one example of how money works that so few people actually know.
Yeah, insurance contracts are one of the favorite tools of the rich. And, you know, I've interviewed rich people since 1984. I wrote a book called How Rich People Think about all these interviews about 10 years ago. And it's one of the things that always baffled me in the beginning of the interviews. They'd say, you know, well, I have an insurance contract over here and I've got five different policies. And I used to ask them all the time, why, you're rich. Why do you need insurance? I mean, why would you need that? And they say, well, it's not about the death benefit. People think insurance is about dying and the death benefit, which of course it's one benefit of it. But what rich people use it for is a tax shelter. And because the money that comes from insurance out of insurance policies is tax free. And so they bury money in insurance contracts. That's why they have multiple contracts. This is how the rich get richer. And people have no idea. They just think, well, insurance, life insurance is about a death benefit. Well, it's about much more than a death benefit. You just have to know how to use those contracts.
Yeah, I mean, that's on a whole different level. I mean, one of the sayings that I always kind of chuckle at is he makes good money, you know, and it's kind of Robert Kiyosaki-ish, but, you know, that's kind of a rich dad, poor dad way of looking at things. You know, if you make good money, you're still making a decent amount of money, but you're still on a salary and you're never going to get wealthy that way.
It's difficult. You know, I was working at a convention in Vegas this year with Sharon Lecter, who wrote Rich Dad, Poor Dad with Robert Kiyosaki. And
yeah,
Tom Matthews and I were promoting our book, and she was promoting Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And her and I had long conversations about this backstage during the three-day convention, just about basically what you're talking about, how, you know, you've got this tiny percentage of people that understand how money works, and they have all the money in this country. And everyone else, while totally capable of understanding these concepts, it's not rocket science, just have no idea how they're acquiring and getting richer all the time, where the middle class is getting poorer. And it's a lot of it is just education.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I mean, it's a whole different level. It's such that even a little bit of knowledge definitely goes a long way. And most people are intimidated by the whole thing because there's a culture of intimidating the people who aren't wealthy yet to keep them there.
Oh, yeah. They don't want you to know. I mean, that's what people ask all the time. We were doing a live stream, Tom Matthews and I, my co-author, were doing a live stream broadcast in the financial services industry on Tuesday night. And one of the questions that came in, they said, why don't we get this education? Because the financial services industry doesn't want you to know how money works, because the less you know, the richer they get.
Yeah, that applies to a lot of fields in this life.
It does. It does. Missing. I mean, look at cars. You know, we used to go buy a car, you know, back in the day before the internet, and you had very little information about it. And now the car dealers, I've worked for the automotive industry for years. And one of the guys that's actually a board member, I won't say his name, of course, but at Fiat Chrysler Automotive, which is one of the biggest groups in the world, car groups in the world, he said, you know what, here's our real problem. People come in to the dealerships now and they're educated. They know what we paid for the car and they're not going to pay a penny more. And he said, this is a big problem for us. So, I mean, you think about that. They've been operating, all these industries, as you mentioned, have been operating on us not knowing how money works and what pricing and how pricing works and markups work and fees work. And now we're getting educated and they're making less money as a result.
One of the definite real benefits of there having been an internet for the last 20 years. I mean, you know, Yelp, TripAdvisor, Google reviews have pretty much made it such there is no longer a dishonest mechanic out there who can stay in business.
Exactly. Yeah. Good thing, right? Because you never knew. I mean, the engine light comes on. I mean, I'm a terrible mechanic. I don't have any interest in that stuff. You take the car in, you think, do I really need four new tires and a transmission, you know, this or that, or a carburetor or whatever it is? And like you say, now it'd be tough to get away with that now.
Yeah, 100%. So I have to ask, how does knowing about money make one mentally tougher? Or perhaps asked a different way, how does mental toughness help us keep from being a sucker? I mean, is it avoiding impulse purchases, which obviously happen in a moment of mental weakness for sure? Or is there something more to it than that?
Well, I think for one, it makes you more confident. You mentioned that, you know, you felt like you said earlier in the show that taking responsibility was a big part of mental toughness. And of course, I agreed with that. And I think that's part of it. Now you're taking responsibility for your financial future. So the next time you look at buying something, like, you know, just like you said, these loans at 28% or 17% or whatever they are, you think, okay, before I actually purchase it, I'm actually going to map this out over a 5-year period or a 3-year period or whatever the loan may be, and see how much this new TV is going to actually cost me over that period of time. And actually figure it out with a calculator, then say, gee, a $2,000, whatever it is, TV is now going to cost me $6,000. Can I really afford a $6,000 television? You know, if you can, great, buy it. If you can't, you know, then maybe you want to pull back. So it's a way of taking responsibility for your financial future, which is a pretty big deal. You know, if you can write a check, you can solve a problem. You don't have a problem.
Well, I'll tell you, the whole concept of negotiation, requires mental toughness. You know, you mentioned the car dealerships several times. If you walk into a car dealership and they can make you want this car so badly, you're not going to leave without it. They've already won the negotiation process. The ability to walk away from something you want because the negotiation didn't go the way you wanted it to go, at least not yet, requires an insane amount of mental toughness when there's something you can absolutely afford and it's right there in front of you and you want to buy it.
Oh, no question about it. I just bought a car recently and I traded in my old car, and I had the car for a while because I'm not really a big car person. I drive to the airport back when we used to fly. I drive to the airport and back.
Yeah. Right.
But I'm not a big car person, but I was going through, you know, they play the game with you. Well, we'll give you this much for your car and then we'll take it off of the, you know, the top line of the new car and et cetera. And it's kind of a little shell game they play, a little three card Monty they play with the numbers to confuse you. And I literally wrote it all out in front of the guy, and we went through it, and I bought from one dealer instead of another because I had all the numbers mapped out and I got him to confirm it. You know, if you'll take your time and do that, I think I probably saved a pretty decent amount of money just because I actually mapped it out, as opposed to just saying, hey, I'll take the car, which I've done before, by the way. I've not always done that, but I'm trying to get better like everybody else. Yeah.
Yeah. I may have bought a car or two that were on a multi-month waiting list, which isn't a very good.
I know, right?
Nope. Negotiating position.
Where's your leverage there? And I've done the same.
Right.
Oh, I walked to the dealers and bought them on the spot when I didn't need a car. And I was just like, so dumb, but overpaid, of course. But
yeah, we're not going to go there. That's me and motorcycles and bicycle parts, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of the questions that comes to mind that you should absolutely avoid when buying a car is, what kind of monthly payment are you looking for? Because then they can back into the number with all kinds of crazy costs.
Oh, yeah.
And just protract the number of payments out until you're happy. That's a dangerous one. The other thing that's dangerous is to not look at the individual numbers, but just look at one big lump sum that includes your trade-in and the cost of the new car.
Right.
Yeah, that's another thing. People don't realize they can sell their trade-in to one dealer and buy from another. You can get bids from CarMax or a whole bunch of different companies and sell to the highest bidder, and then still buy your car from someone else. And you can also get a dealership to sell you a car that's sitting on another lot right now, another dealership.
That's right.
Yeah. All those are car industry tricks.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. They make all their money in financing. That's the thing. They don't make it on selling the car. They make it on the financing. So, you know, there's a bunch of money there. But, you know, we get excited. We go in and we just, you qualified. No problem. You qualified for the loan. You go, yay. And you want your car. And you're not thinking about all the paperwork they're spitting out, you know, and you're signing everything under the sun and they're making a fortune on you and you don't know it, you know.
Not mentally tough at all. And by the way, if you get duped by someone manipulative into co-signing for their loan, just plan on kissing that money goodbye.
Yeah, you're going to pay for that loan. You just bought a loan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. The person who is dumb enough to co-sign for anyone
based
on manipulation tactics is the one who's not mentally tough in that scenario.
Exactly.
You know, I'm a big fan of a certain TED Talk by Dr. Angela Duckworth, who's an academic who lives in the Philadelphia metro area. And it was on grit, which translated basically as mental toughness. And she would argue that developing grit in children is perhaps the number one indicator of life success, more so than IQ, EQ, good looks, athletic talents, good grades, good upbringing, financial, socioeconomic status, any of that stuff. She would say kids who are mentally tough grow up to be successful. I would love to have your input on how we can raise our sons and daughters to be mentally tough. And I would also love your input, maybe perhaps in tandem with this, on how being mentally tough enhances our relationships with women, just family in general, whether it's parenthood, marriage, either way.
Oh, yeah, that's a loaded question for sure. But I agree. Angela Duckworth's done some wonderful work. As you said, she's an academic, and I would agree with that assessment. I think it's it'd probably be hard to prove, but I would agree with it, that grit or mental toughness or, you know, whatever you want to label this mindset that we talk about. I call it mental toughness. Other people call it different things, but it's the same concept. And I would agree because, you know, life obviously has a way of beating you up from the time you're a child. And if you can keep coming back and become, I call it becoming a comeback artist, and just keep going back, keep bouncing back. And I think that probably is the number one life skill. I would, if I had children, which I don't, I would try to instill that in them more than anything else by telling them, look, here's what's going to happen. You're going to lose sometimes. It's part of life. You might lose more than you win. But if you keep coming back, eventually you'll probably get what you want, because most people won't come back. They'll quit early for lots of different reasons. So if you can develop that in kids, that's what's, as you mentioned earlier, Scott, that's why I love sports. And this is why I'm into this whole thing, because I was, you know, as I mentioned, I was a tennis player. Everything I needed to know about life, pretty much, I guess, maybe outside of some personal things, I learned on a tennis court, losing most of the time. I learned more losing, I think, than I did winning. But yeah, and so I think that's a big part with kids. And then in terms of relationships, I think with women, I mean, I've been married so long. I've been married for 34 years and we've been together for 36 years. But I think you're right. You mentioned this before we went on the air, that I think the women are more attracted to men who are mentally tough, because I think this may sound very sexist, but I think there's a lot of data to back. I know there's a lot of data to back this up, that a lot of times women innately are looking for security at some level. Not that they're not self-sufficient, because of course they are, as self-sufficient as men are. But I think there is something about a woman being with a man that's secure in himself and has a level of mental toughness, and being defined as, let's say what you said, the ability to take responsibility for himself, that she feels comfortable being with him because she knows he's going to take responsibility. And that gives her a level of security that she may not have in any other way.
Well, you can talk out loud like that on this show, because that's one of the main tenets of everything we talk about around here.
Okay.
Is that the ability to make women feel safe and comfortable in your presence is a pillar of masculinity. Masculinity being a sexual catalyst to sexual attraction. Masculine and feminine polarity catalyzing each other to produce sexual attraction. So that's right on target. I would also add to that that part of being mentally tough in a relationship or even in parenthood is not letting the actions of someone you love phase you to the point where you're either doubting the love or responding in anger to them or lashing out at them. And we talked about that on a recent show relative to being a man who is emotional yet still masculine. And it was a wonderful conversation, and that ties right into it. And I think grittiness, mental toughness also applies to giving your children and your significant other a little room to fail. You know, they're going to disappoint you sometimes because they're human. And we talked about that in the show with Alex Allman a little bit, but it's a very, very good point. I think whenever you're pessimistic, whenever you're just waiting for the shoe to drop, that's an indication to me of lack of grit, lack of mental toughness. So I would add that to the conversation as well. The name of the book is How Money Works, Stop Being a Sucker. And you can find it on my Amazon influencer page by going to mountaintoppodcast.com/Amazon. And you can also link to it directly by going to mountaintoppodcast.com/toughness, T-O-U-G-H-N-E-S-S. And that will take you directly to Amazon, where you can get you some. Also, on my Amazon influencer page, while I'm at it, I'm going to give you a link to his infamous book, Die Fat or Get Tough, which was absolutely instrumental in my quest to lose the kind of weight I needed to lose, which was a healthy chunk, 50 pounds, or an unhealthy chunk, 50 pounds. And be sure you read the reviews, because you guys who are gritty and mentally tough will get a huge kick out of the people who are just complaining and saying, oh, you're being so mean. It's not my fault. Also, along with How Money Works, Stop Being a Sucker, you'll find 177 Mental Toughness Secrets of the World Class, which is Steve Seibold's book, on exactly what we're talking about today. So you can get a heck of a trifecta there by scoring all three of those books on Amazon. Steve, what a great conversation, an essential one, and one I don't think we've ever had on this show, really. So thank you so much for coming back and sharing your wisdom with us, my friend.
Hey, I appreciate it, Scott. And congratulations on your weight loss and the success of your show.
Yeah, man. And absolutely mega congratulations on the success of your books. One of the things that I mistakenly and unfortunately failed to mention until now is that at the time we are publishing this show, your book, How Money Works, Stop Being a Sucker, is number one in the world for personal finance. And you, of course, have appeared on the New York Times bestseller list many times. And, you've sold hundreds of thousands of copies of this book, which is just fascinating and fantastic, and surely a testament to how good you are at what you do. So yeah, guys, once again, go to mountaintoppodcast.com/toughness and get that book. And guys, if you haven't yet visited mountaintoppodcast.com, what I'm going to invite you to do is talk to me personally. There's a red button in the upper right-hand corner of that page, and you can schedule on the fly 25 minutes with me for free. We'll talk about where you are right now, where you want to be in your life, and perhaps put a plan of action together to get those results for you, to get those goals met in your life. A lot of you guys are on the fence about that. And what I'm going to do is invite you, in the spirit of what Steve was talking about in this show, to be gritty, get some mental toughness, and make this happen in your life. Take that bull by the horns and let's do this thing. Sign up to talk to me for 25 minutes at mountaintoppodcast.com. And until I talk to you again real soon, this is Scott McKay from X and Y Communications in San Antonio, Texas. Be good out there.
The Mountaintop Podcast is produced by X and Y Communications. All rights reserved worldwide. Be sure to visit www.mountaintoppodcast.com for show notes. And while you're there, sign up for the free X and Y Communications newsletter for men. This is Ed Roy Odom speaking for the Mountaintop Podcast.